May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Tom Carroll. With me today is Jeff Fitzgerald, Dave Stark, on behalf of appellant Luke Schlapp. Luke's mother, Leah, is also in the courtroom with us today. Luke is an 8-year-old boy from Grand Junction who's been diagnosed with severe autism. We're here today asking this court to overturn the decision of the Department, the Department of Health Care Policy and Financing, as upheld by the district court, to deny Luke a Medicaid waiver. Despite the fact that Luke meets the published eligibility criteria for this waiver, he was denied on the basis that his needs are developmental or behavioral and not medical or physical. This so-called medically fragile requirement is a new, unpublished rule. It is therefore contrary to law and was arbitrary and capricious for the department to apply it. Briefly, Your Honor, Medicaid is a joint federal and state program by which the federal government sends funds to the states to then distribute and administer to primarily low-income individuals for medical care. An alternative means to receive Medicaid funding is through these so-called waiver programs. Typically, the waiver is of the income requirements that would typically apply. In Colorado, Medicaid is administered by the department, and more specifically within the department by the Medical Services Board. Now, the Medical Services Board is appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and is statutorily charged and given the authority to publish regulations regarding the eligibility for Medicaid services. And that's exactly what the Medical Services Board did in this case. We're here today about a waiver called the Home and Community-Based Services Children's Waiver. And the Medical Services Board promulgated 7 discrete, comprehensive criteria to determine whether a child like Luke is eligible for the children's waiver. Of those 7 criteria, there's but one that we're here in dispute today. And that criterion is whether, Luke has met the established minimum criteria for nursing facility level of care. In order to determine whether an applicant like Luke meets the established minimum, we look to another set of general regulations that apply to several of the Medicaid waiver programs. And within these regulations, it's stated that the comprehensive and uniform tool to determine eligibility is a series of forms called the ULTC 100.2. Within the ULTC 100.2, again, the comprehensive and uniform assessment tool, we have what is a quantitative analysis of whether an applicant like Luke can carry on various activities of daily living.
Mr. Carroll, why do you disagree with the department's view that the ULTC 100.2 form is not the only document that's used to determine eligibility?
I wouldn't say that I disagree, Your Honor. It's become clear throughout the course of the briefing, in addition to this quantitative, they're scored 1 through 3. In addition to this quantitative analysis, it's become clear that there are a series of other forms. For example, this physician's medical information page. And we agree that that's technically part of the ULTC 100.2. But as will become clear through the course of my argument, that PIMP, nor any other form within the ULTC 100.2 provides the criteria that the state has applied here. It's an information form that a physician fills out.
Let me just back up a second. So how is anyone supposed to know exactly what is in the ULT 100.2 form or document or documents to determine eligibility?
That's a fantastic question, Your Honor, and I wish I knew. The best we've been able to determine so far, the regulations themselves are not particularly clear. In fact, you'll find under the programmatic regulations for this particular waiver, it also refers to something called the Pediatric Functional Assessment Instrument, which to the best of my research anywhere doesn't exist. So the best we've been able to determine so far, as attached to some of the department's briefing below, is that there's a single website that contains various links to various forms that must together comprise the ULTC.
So as of this afternoon, what is your understanding of what is in the ULT 100.2? So you said the activities of daily living form and the PMIP is two, if I am understanding you correctly.
Correct, Your Honor.
And what else, if anything?
I can say there's a handful of other forms that have not been at issue in this case. I haven't seen them discussed in the briefing, and they weren't brought up with any prominence in the record.
Okay. Counsel, assuming, for the sake of argument, just hypothetically, that medically fragile or was a condition or a requirement expressed in the regulations, mm-hmm. would the materials in the 100.2 packet enable expression of whether that the underlying condition was medical as opposed to behavioral?
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, that depends on just how precisely medically fragile was enunciated in the regulatory criteria. For example, were it to simply say a child must be medically fragile, period, I would contend that there must be some sort of greater regulatory guidance from the Medical Services Board to the department to implement that regulation. Take a look here with autism. As far as we're concerned, autism is certainly a medical disease. He goes to see medical doctors, is treated with medical prescriptions. So in the case that it would end with a period, medically fragile period, we would continue to argue that there must be some sort of regulatory guidance about where the state's drawing the line about what medically fragile means.
Well, we had that guidance, first of all, in the enabling statutes, the federal, going all the way back to the federal law. It talks about requiring a demonstration that the applicant has a need for hospital or nursing level or nursing facility level care. Mm-hmm. That is repeated in the state enabling statutes. Mm-hmm. And nursing facility care, which is what we're concerned about here, is defined in the regulations.
Correct, Your Honor. And I'm glad you mentioned that. Nursing facility is defined. And that's at 10 CCR 2505-10. Section 8.406. And as you'll see there are in fact three types of nursing facilities. We have skilled nursing facilities, intermediate nursing facilities, and residential care. It's become clear from the testimony before the ALJ, through the ALJ's decision, up to the briefing before this court, that the department has only applied the standard for skilled nursing care. Now, the regulatory standard here asks or requires that an applicant meet the minimum requirements for nursing facility level of care. And the state applied the most stringent requirement for nursing facility level of care.
So we've got this amalgam of enabling laws and regulations that you, I think you said a minute ago, weren't clear. If they're not clear, why don't we defer to a reasonable interpretation of those regulations by the entity that is charged with enforcing them, the agency?
Your Honor, to begin to answer your question, I would begin that with respect to the eligibility for the children's waiver, the eligibility criteria are clear. The Medical Services Board promulgated seven criteria, and that was the way that they interpreted the enabling statute.
Can the board, does it have any authority to establish criteria that are in contravention of its enabling laws?
Which enabling laws, Your Honor?
Federal or state, the ones that allow the program in the first place.
Certainly not, and so I would point out this Medicaid program, as promulgated under the current regulations, was in fact approved by the federal government, and there's no reason to believe that it is in contravention of anything. I realize the state's taken that position, but that just draws out the fact that at one point, Luke was eligible for this waiver. He went off of it, and he applied again. And there's no dispute that Luke is the same boy with the same conditions and the same needs. But in between, something changed. And it's our argument that what changed is that the department instituted a new rule. And
why is every interpretation that a department has of its enabling laws or its regulations a new rule?
They're not, Your Honor. Not every interpretation is a rule. We have the difference, of course, between a legislative rule and an interpretive rule.
Right, and the interpretive rules are not subject to the APA, correct?
Correct. However, Your Honor, an interpretive rule simply describes the types of factors that an agency might consider in future proceedings. And a characterization of a particular rule, an interpretive rule cannot decide the issue to which it's addressed. I'd say furthermore, considering that the Medical Services Board is the publicly appointed, statutorily authorized interpretive body here, the rules that they interpreted, namely the specific statutory criteria, have the force of law. And another interpretation that runs contrary to the Medical Services Board regulations is contrary to law.
So So here we have a situation where, at least from the agency's perspective, they were not enforcing their enabling legislation correctly. They were told to do it correctly by the centers. The centers came in, did an audit, told them to do it correctly. So then they do it correctly. Are you saying that because they have been told they must comply with their enabling legislation, they have to change their rules in a formal way, otherwise they're locked into what is essentially an illegal application of their enabling legislation?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. Again, the regulatory requirements that we have were promulgated by the Medical Services Board and approved by the federal government. And things were moving along just fine, and in comes the federal government and comes up with it. Well, maybe things should be differently here. But the fact is, we have promulgated regulations governing the criteria for eligibility under this waiver.
But the federal government's complaint was how the regulations were being applied, not with the content of the regulations. It was saying, you're not considering medical need. You need to be considering medical need.
Right, and we stand firmly on the ground that to consider medical need and to categorically disregard behavioral and developmental needs is a significant change that applicants like Luke deserve notice of. And to the extent the public would like to have that decision and decide that we want to comply with federal law, that needs to go through the state's rulemaking procedures. And again, this is a substantive legislative change in the rules that goes beyond the level of an interpretive rule.
So let me understand what you're really saying here. Are you really saying that an agency that is acting illegally in contravention of its enabling legislation must continue to do so unless it changes its regulations through the APA?
Your Honor, I'm not willing to go that far, but I will tell you I don't think that the agency was acting illegally here. Once again, the regulations as promulgated have been approved. There's nothing in the record whatsoever that the federal government has put the state over some sort of a barrel and demanded that these changes be made.
I'm not saying changes in the regulations. I'm saying interpretation and application of the regulations. The federal government thought that was illegal, that the department was ignoring the fundamental threshold criteria of medical need.
Again, Your Honor, I just respectfully must disagree about whether or not this is an interpretive rule or a legislative rule, and under the Administrative Procedures Act, it is our opinion that this is a legislative rule and must go through the rulemaking process.
Mr. Carroll, is there any evidence in the record as to whether or not the federal government changed its interpretation of the statutes or regulations regarding HCBS children's waivers?
The best I'm aware of, Your Honor, is perhaps some testimony before the administrative law judge. And I admit this may be outside the record, but just that the federal government has looked closely at the way Colorado is administrating this. But
you're not aware of any federal changes in regulations?
Guidance. No, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Certainly.
May it please the court. I'm Josh Urquhart, representing the Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing. Just to clarify one thing that was raised a few minutes ago, there is in fact, I think, a couple of references in the testimony before the administrative hearing officer indicating that in fact during an audit with CMS, the department was told that they were applying this and administering the children's waiver program wrong. That in fact the waiver agreement, which is a binding agreement between the federal government and the state government, limited the target group to medically fragile children. And furthermore, that the statute at issue in the case, which requires that for eligibility, applicants must have medical needs sufficient to put them at risk for institutionalization in a nursing home or hospital, that requirement was essentially being ignored when children with solely behavioral or cognitive disabilities that would put them at risk for placement in an intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded, what's known as an ICFMR, that those children were being funneled into the children's waiver program.
So, Mr. Urquhart, do you disagree with Mr. Carroll that autism is a medical need?
Judge, I think that that's I think that's almost a philosophical argument. I think that...
Well, I think it's a practical question that we have to answer in deciding this case.
Well, I don't think it is, actually, because the requirement is not just medical needs in the abstract versus behavioral or cognitive needs. There's a second part in the statute, and that is that put them at risk for placement in a nursing facility or an acute care hospital. And if the question is, does... In general, obviously, each autistic child is different, and we're not speaking as to universal a population. But in general, do the autism-based care needs put autistic children at risk for nursing home or hospital placement? I think the answer is no. The types of needs they have, the supervision needs, the bathing needs, the toileting needs, those are needs that are specifically addressed in the ICF MR context.
I'm sorry, I interrupted your answer.
No, I was going to move on to another point.
I'm interested in the definition of nursing care facility. We just heard that there are three such definitions. Are you contending that Luke here would not qualify for placement in any of those?
Yes, that's right. And as we say in our briefs, the department has interpreted this medical need criteria in the statute in conjunction with the medically fragile language in the waiver agreement as essentially implying the first of those categories, skilled nursing care. Now, even if this court disagrees with that interpretation, even if this court views it as placement in any of the nursing facilities, it's important to look at the department regs where they specify the types of services provided by any of those. For example, an intermediate nursing facility has to provide skilled nursing care. Well, excuse me, I'll take a step back. Nursing care by a registered or practicing nurse. It has to be under a physician's supervision. It has to make sure that the patient is taking his medication. It's medically based, even in this lesser degree of nursing facility care. You should contrast that with the care needs that are provided by an ICF-MR, which include, as I said before, behavioral-based needs, making sure that the patient can bathe correctly, making sure that he can feed himself correctly, making sure that he, did, most importantly, doesn't present a risk to himself or others.
Mr. Urquhart, just as a practical question, is the ICF-MR waiver the one that Luke has been found eligible for?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, on two separate occasions, and this is a really important point. In their reply brief, they contend that Luke has never been certified for placement in an ICF-MR. He was on the children's waiver, the children with autism waiver for 2 years. By department regulation, and that regulation is 8519-4A3, a children with autism waiver recipient can only be certified as eligible for an ICF-MR. It doesn't include nursing facility certification. It doesn't include hospital certification. So this idea that nothing's changed, well, something has to have changed if he previously was ICF-MR certified and now contends, no, I'm not ICF-MR certified, I'm nursing facility certified.
Maybe I'm confused. There's an extensive support waiver that he's been found eligible for, is that correct?
Correct, mostly. My understanding, and I had this discussion in the past weeks with the regulators, is that he's on the waiting list for the CES program. And to get on the waiting list, you have to be certified as at risk for placement in an ICF-MR. Now, my understanding is that when you get to the top of the waiting list to actually go on the program, you have to be recertified to make sure that that's still the same. But my understanding is to get on the waiting list in the first place, he was certified as ICF-MR.
And do you know how long that waiting list is, by any chance?
I don't. It varies based on the particular time you're talking about.
And is there a waiting list for the HCBS Children's Waiver Program?
There is. My understanding is it's shorter, but frankly, Judge, that's a policy decision for the legislature.
Oh, I understand that. I'm just trying to understand the differences between the different waiver programs.
Well, and that's certainly one practical difference is waiting timely. Another difference, and it's kind of glossed over in the briefs, is the services offered by these programs
are very different. The services offered by the Children's Waiver Program, as you might expect, being a program intended to address medical needs, are medical in nature. They're nursing care. They're you know, monitoring under a physician's supervision. The services provided by the CES program are developmentally. They're supervision. They're behavioral therapy, and it's not a difference that should be trivialized. There's evidence in the record that the reason that Luke Schlapp went to the Children with Autism waiver in the first place is that the services provided under that waiver program were far more appropriate for his autism-based needs. And the same principle applies with respect to the CES versus Children's waiver.
Counsel, I have a question. It goes right to what I think is the crux of Luke's argument here, and that is that at one point in time, specifically when Luke first applied for this waiver, he was deemed eligible. And then later, he was deemed ineligible because the department, I think under some direction from the federal government, decided that it must enforce these regulations with this medical need requirement in mind. And that in so doing, it really changed the ball field, I mean the rules or something, and that in so doing it's only fair that the department then go through some regulatory process to inform people that this change has occurred. How do you respond to that?
I think that's a very good observation, Judge Jones, and I think in all my research it really implicates a question of first impression for this court. And that question is, if the department is misapplying or misadministering its enabling statute, its regulatory guidance, whatever the authority is, years passed, and it comes to the realization, whether federal regulators tell them otherwise or whether it's someone who's the department that looks at the rules for the first time, that it was doing it wrong. Does the department have to promulgate new regulations to do it right as it should have been doing all along? The department's position is that that can't be right. That would tie an agency's hands to be unable to go back and revisit errors in the way it was administering a program in the past.
Well, it doesn't really tie your hands. You just have to go through the APA procedures for promulgating a rule.
Yes, but these programs, and as a lawyer for the Medicaid agency, and I know maybe as well as anyone, they're so complex. There's so many of them that requiring a medical services board that meets once a month to go back and correct every error that has been located in a given time period would just be impossible. It would stop them from doing the job that they should be doing in the first instance, which is enforcing and implementing the statutes.
Well, Mr. Urquhart, the flip side of that, of course, is that if the regulations were amended, and I assume they still could be, that they would provide guidance to members of the public more clearly about the eligibility criteria for the HCBS Children's Waiver Program.
Judge, I think that just begs the question of why hasn't the department amended the regs? And
I don't know why the department hasn't, but I think wouldn't you agree, though, that if the department were to amend the regulations, that it would be more clear to potential applicants as to what their eligibility criteria are?
I agree it could be. I mean, there's a trade-off with any time you make a statute or regulation more specific. On the one hand, you certainly make it clear for the people that specificity is intended to address. On the other hand, you run into the problem that by making it too specific, it can be interpreted as excluding people in situations that fall outside that. So, for example, let's say in this case, the department amended its reg to basically clarify that children with purely behavioral needs like autism aren't eligible for the Children's Waiver Program in the absence of any you know, comorbid health issues. Well, then what happens when a Down syndrome child or some other child comes along and says, well, you say autism, you don't say anything about my condition? And that's one reason that the agencies do have to maintain some flexibility when they're promulgating regs, because they might go to problems that have yet to come up.
Yes, but Luke's concern here, as I understand it, is that the regulations currently don't express specifically that there has to be a medical need. And as you define it, a medical need is something that's not either developmental or mental illness.
Well, I think that's not entirely right, because the regs do require that the individual, the applicant, be at risk for placement in a nursing facility or hospital. And as I discussed earlier, that's really a term of art. When you look at it, what nursing facilities are defined to do by the regs, they include the medical-based needs. So yes, the regs don't use the word medical, although the statute certainly does. But the regs do indicate the types of facilities that individuals, excuse me, must be at risk for placement at in order to be eligible.
I have one more question I want to ask. This question I asked Mr. Carroll. What exactly is constitutes the ULTC 100.2?
I think Council answered that exactly right. If you go to the department's website, there's a hyperlink, and it says ULTC 100.2, and you click on it, and what happens is it doesn't take you to a single form. I'm sorry, it takes you to maybe four or five different forms. The ones at issue in this case were the ADL assessment form, and then also the physician, professional medical information page, the so-called PMIP. The other forms, since they weren't at issue, I'm afraid I don't know them off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a few minutes left, so I probably should make, I think, two points. The first point here is there's been a tendency in this case to treat the regs is not just silence to the issue of what other factors one has to look at to determine certification, but to portray them as requiring certification when an applicant scores sufficiently high on the ADL assessment portion. I think it's important to note that's not actually what the regs say. The regs say that if someone scores high enough, if they score, I think, a 1 in 2 categories other than supervision or a 2 in supervision, that the department at that point may certify. The language is discretionary on its face. And I think that becomes a little bit clearer when one considers that the ULTC 100.2 is a tool designed to determine eligibility for a wide range of programs, including, for example, the developmentally disabled programs like the CES. And an interpretation of those regs that would make certification mandatory would make no sense. Someone that's at risk for placement in an ICFMR, almost by definition, is in need of extensive supervision. It's one of the criteria. Are they at risk to themselves? Are they at risk to others? It's difficult to imagine anyone that would be at risk for ICFMR placement that wouldn't score a 2 or higher in supervision on the ULTC 100.2. So under the appellant's interpretation, where it's automatic, you score a 2, you're automatically at risk for nursing care, it would essentially combine the ICFMR placement standard and the nursing facility standard. Everyone that's in the former category would be eligible for the latter. And I see I'm now out of time, so I guess the second point will remain unmade.
Thank you.
Your Honors, in my limited time here, I'd like to buzz through what I think are about 5 points I'd like to make. The first, with respect to the other waiver programs or the ICFMRs, these are different programs. And although certain children or certain applicants may not be able to be enrolled in certain programs, we're here talking about eligibility. And he was denied eligibility in the program. Now, each of these programs have a number of other requirements that you may have to meet to finally be enrolled. One of them may be, you know, no duplicative enrollment, but we're here to talk about eligibility. Next, council refers to the definitions of nursing facilities to try to determine or tease out the types of services provided under this waiver. Your Honors, if you look, and I'm sorry to bring it up with me, in what I'll call the introduction to the programmatic eligibility criteria here, the CMS, or the Medical Services Board, says that all services provided by Medicaid and all care management shall be provided under the children's waiver. So there's no limitation for behavioral needs. Next, with respect to this may certify language regarding if Luke meets all the quantitative criteria, you may certify. Well, it's our opinion that if the UL, or the utilization review contractor may certify that Luke meets the criteria, then by definition, he has met the minimum criteria. And that's a fine point. And I realize may is permissive, but there's simply nothing else out there to fill in the wave, the void. And that's why it becomes essentially a mandatory requirement. Finally, Judge Jones, with respect to your question about whether we must promulgate new regulations every time, I was reminded of federal highway transportation funds, for example. And the federal government says that we have to have a certain speed limit. Well, if you want to change the speed limit to keep your funds, you need to change the signs. And that's what we have here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. This case has been concluded, and it will be submitted for a decision. A written opinion will issue in due course. The court thanks both counsel for their excellent arguments. Really, the briefing, the arguments, just outstanding, and we really appreciate it. So very nice.